Mine only, and they do not represent the views or opinions of the fire department.
Oh, and just if there are new listeners, they won't have any idea who Tanya Vidovich is. And so you had to sue, actually, because you had quite a... Well, let's go through your case. That there, you were endangering, quotes, your fetus and your pregnancy. And and so you had some pretty arduous challenges, you might say, and you were fired.
I went through three pregnancies with the fire department. Each one I faced discrimination and retaliation for.
And how did you face discrimination and retaliation?
From job assignments to promotion skipping to failed evaluation, citing that I was pregnant. So a number of different items. Firefighters literally wrote in memos and requested not to work with me while pregnant. So it was a lot.
And yet you passed rigorous tests with full 40 pounds equipment when you were 8 months pregnant, right?
I had to do three fit for duty tests while in gear. When I went, the OCC health doctor said that that it was not the normal to do it in gear, but it was requested specifically for me to be able to do this in gear. And during court, they said that they'd never heard of anybody ever doing this test before. So I had to do it three times. So then after I received my failing yearly evaluation for being pregnant, I filed suit. And the day after filing suit, I was terminated. So that was March 2016. So we went through the past 2 years in federal court. And we won with a jury of seven people in federal court here in Tampa Bay. And they determined that that there was pregnancy discrimination and retaliation.
And I'm going to go back because how many women had been with the fire department here in Tampa before you?
40 years worth. The first woman, I think Mitchie Wright, was hired 42 years now because I've been gone for 2 years. So it's a decent amount of women. I think that we are about at 5%, 5 or 6% of women on the job, but that's only recently that the numbers have jumped up so high. So I don't know the actual total of women on the job.
And how does that compare, say, to a city in comparable size, Illinois, Ohio, any other place?
It's low all over the country. It's not an equal representation of women as far as the community goes. It is usually under 6%. I think the average is about 3% nationwide. So women are not equally represented in the fire department across the country.
And now there's an unusual kind of work conditions for fire departments, you know, where most of us go to work 8 hours, 10 hours, whatever, 5 days a week, and then you've got the weekends off. But the living conditions, and is this a problem that the fire departments seem to have trouble adjusting to? Is it the congregate living? I mean, is that a major obstacle?
It depends on the department and how they handle it. A lot of departments have put in women's bathrooms in every station, and it's just recently, I think it was back in 2014 or 15, where they finally, after, you know, 40 years, put up petitions, privacy petitions. But you know, there's things that they could do to make it more welcoming to women. For instance, having, you know, a pregnancy policy would be wonderful, breastfeeding policy would be wonderful, having more women in positions, you know, having the same promotional opportunities, and you know.
And you're specifically in fire rescue.
Yes.
And so tell us, what is that about?
So Tampa Fire joined with the rescue, I forget exactly when, it was before my time, but it is Tampa Fire Rescue. So the majority of the units, the engines and the rescue cars are paramedics and firefighters. And so the majority of the people on the job serve both roles as paramedics and firefighters. Most of it is medical calls. I think I want to say like 90% of the calls are medical.
Well, and to me, this is almost the interface with the fire department that we have in the community. And it's critical. I mean, I can't think of a time when you've got a medical emergency, maybe your loved one has collapsed, or you have a serious problem with a child or yourself, et cetera. And the interface of those people with the community, to me, is the whole background of community, if you will. And so, I don't mean to be bad, but I think if any place you would also want women, it would be there.
It's one place that you would expect for there to be equality and equal everything. That's what I expect.
Yeah, because so many times in panic, you know, and lives are at stake, that often, you know, women have experienced, like you've got a couple kids, they're used to kind of emergencies, if you will, that can seem life-threatening or maybe not as serious, but until you can really assess the situation and calmly handle it. And so, in a way, I think that women are really quite prepared for this.
We're an underutilized, vital component of our community.
And I was troubled when the Tampa Bay Times did quite a report, you know, on the incidence of drug and alcohol problems.
I read that as well. And yeah, you see it. You see, you know, you hear the bragging, you hear I myself don't drink or smoke or do drugs, but you see people that are, I don't know if they're, it's just a part of their lifestyle. And it's alarming to me.
But was it a part of their lifestyle before they started getting involved in this work? Now, you probably wouldn't know that. To me, that would be very emotionally draining. I mean, you'd really have to realize that you can't deal with death or near death regularly. And always the unexpected. You might get a really very violent situation, and both parties are injured, et cetera, and you have to try and address this and help them. I mean, this is a very emotionally challenging and very draining. And I think that you have to recognize, you know, in the military, they recognize these kind of emotional stresses, and so they try and deal with it, you know, both before and afterwards. And so I think, to me at least, if you are having a problem with drugs and abuse, it's kind of an escape, if you will.
It does seem like an escape, and I would think that, yeah, we could do better as a department, as a country. We could do better as far as the mental health of people, because it does seem like it would be an escape or calling out. It's a way of dealing with it. I think that especially in the fire department, firefighters think that they need to be strong. And that is with all aspects of their life. So they just push it down deep, all of the emotions that it's traumas that you see. So if you're not able to talk about it and say, hey, this hurt to see this and this is how it's affecting me, then they're going to bring it home and they're going to internalize it and seek other, you know, ways of dealing with it, which unfortunately could be drugs or alcohol.
Well, you know, strong people can cry.
Yeah.
Strong people can show that they are very aware and that they do relate to the emotions.
Yeah, I'm a strong person and I cry, and I always say my tears are not weakness. They are their strength, and it's sadness for an unjust society.
Well, and you know, in a way, you know, I just got done reading, you know, the Dear Madam President. Jennifer Palmieri wrote this. She was Hillary Clinton's main press liaison. And it's really quite fascinating because she's talking to the first woman who's going to be the president, because she said that woman is going to be a president. And one of the things that she really points out, and I'm thinking this in regard to a fire department, which obviously has, you know, some problems, I think, emotionally dealing, and the macho, so to speak, be tough, always be strong, handle this, but it can have a price. And she says that one of the real problems Hillary Clinton had is that in a way they were forcing her to be a man, and that mm-hmm. she said a very important thing for the future woman president is be yourself. You know, don't be afraid to cry. Don't be afraid to show your emotions. Don't be afraid to deal with things the way you deal with it, because this has to change.
Well, it is strange. I mean, even with these gender roles, men feel like they have to be a certain way, and women have to feel like they have to be a certain way. And in reality, you should just be true to your own self on how you feel, and not have to feel like you need to fit into these certain roles. But yeah, I mean, you shouldn't feel like you have to be more masculine in terms of what society thinks masculinity is in order to fulfill a certain role.
Yeah, and again, Jennifer points out that it's a man's world.
Yes.
And that's got to change.
Yes.
Because it really isn't working all that well.
No, it's not.
No, but I mean, a fire department to me is a very natural place for women to be great, great jobs and great contributors to society.
Great leaders.
Yeah, really. And to me, to have this kind of opprobrium and discrimination, if you will, that it hurts everybody.
There are a few, and now mind you, after I was terminated, they did promote a couple women to chief. to admin chiefs, which is a great step. It's a great step in this department.
Yeah, and so I'm going back to you, because when we last talked to you, you had to take retraining again. So yes. Go through how it's been, and now that you are back, who are you with, et cetera, and what's happening now?
So it's hard. I guess I didn't expect, but I would have loved for the city to, after saying that I was going to be reinstated, to have a public apology and say, I'm sorry. We made mistakes. Let's have a discussion and learn from this. And, you know, let's work on making it better for everybody. That hasn't happened yet. I was put in a, again, not much notice, put in a 6-week retraining. And I actually got it done in 4 weeks. So I got it done faster than expected, but it was over 50 items that I needed to complete to get back on the streets. But it was more than double what new rookies had to do before they got on the streets. And I come in with 7.5 years experience. So it was interesting. I mean, it was difficult. That schedule, that 40-hour work week is hard to do. I was driving, 2.5 hours a day, not really getting to see my family for those 4 weeks. And then, I didn't know what shift I was going to be on, and my husband's work schedule, is set months in advance. So then all of a sudden, the last few days of the 4 weeks, they finally gave me my where I was going to be stationed in my shift. And again, I put in my requests, but I requested to be a part of the conversation, and I requested, who's at the station so I can kind of talk about it. And so I wasn't really allowed in that conversation. Which, so I ended up being put at a station, and the people have, it's mixed reactions there. A couple people seem, supportive, and a couple less so. But the position is a jerrying position, which means that I go into this station, and it's not necessarily where I'm going to be most days. They could send me to any station in the...
A jerrying station.
Yeah, it just means that... not a jerrying station, it's a position where I have less seniority than other firefighters at that station on that shift, so that they will stay because they have more seniority, and I will go. So any other station... So I could be with a different captain, a different crew every day. And sometimes it's welcomed and sometimes it's not. My very first day on, I was there for 5 minutes before I was, told that I was going to be at a different station, and I hadn't even been given my locker or unpacked. And I was told that I was going to be sent to a station where just a couple weeks ago, before that, the person who I was going to be with, he screamed at me. In 6 inches away from my face, screamed at me to the point where I asked a witness to come in because I was fearful of him. And then magically,
and
there was.
Can I ask, why was he screaming at you?
Because I asked to be put on the Human Relations Committee, which is a committee that's supposed to represent women and minorities in the fire department and issue their, it's like an advisory council. And he didn't want me on it. He was the person who appoints that.
And I'm going to go back. A rookie, totally new, had less training than you did. And you had 7.5 years of experience.
Yes.
And why was that? Did it give you any reason? Is that somewhat arbitrary? In other words, are a lot of these things arbitrary?
It is very arbitrary. It had never, there wasn't even a list before of things that had to be done and completed. I talked to two firefighters who had been reinstated, and they said that they only had to do a couple things, I think a week maybe, just to get through it. And most of it was just easy, training. So we asked for the list of items that the other male firefighters had to do, and they said that there's never been a list. So it's completely arbitrary depending upon what HR and the personnel chief want to do.
Well, it's troubling because after a situation like winning your lawsuit, and it was bitterly fought and mm-hmm. bitterly contested.
Yeah, it's still not closed. It's still going on.
Oh, I thought that Buckhorn finally dropped it.
He dropped the appeal, but it's not closed.
Why?
they'll do it when they want, I guess. I don't know. I'm not in the legal avenue, so I don't know.
But I mean, you know, after a point, and, you know, I think community reaction to that, they said, hey, you know, this is enough. Mm-hmm. We're spending a fortune for this, and just lawyers, et cetera. And so there are choices after a suit like that.
Well, they just, I think they're contesting because I'm almost $30,000 out of pocket for my expenses. So we requested that to be reimbursed, and I think they're fighting part of it. So
every point that can be contested is being contested.
Yeah.
And so after a suit like that, just as a general manner of speaking, and I'm not saying this is necessarily the case, that people can decide, okay. And being this was such an intense public relations, and because in this time now where women are really ticked, Me Too, it's coming out of justification. And women are not going to tolerate this. We're just not going to tolerate this kind of treatment. And, you know, we have come to realize, like Jennifer Palmieri's and others, that this is a man's world and it's got to change. Because it's not a really good situation in most instances. And so, you know, that you can either say, okay, let's address this. You know, did we do some things wrong? Was she difficult to work with? Let's see. Let's work something out because we don't want this again.
Conversation is important.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Or you can take the attitude, well, she won, she shouldn't have, and we're going to make her life a living hell.
That seems to be the latter.
And I think it's really, really troubling. And it's not only immature, but it really kind of represents, frankly, it kind of illustrates the problems.
Yeah.
And so you're not with any station, so every day.
No, I'm assigned to station.
Oh, you're assigned to station, but there are different ones every day.
Well, I'm assigned to the station, and they could choose to keep me there if they wanted to, but I have less seniority. So they don't have to. And I've already been told, because I requested, I said, you know, at least give me a couple months just to get settled in and don't jerry me. And I was told no.
And so I'm curious, is there any avenue you have of addressing problems or complaints? Or is this all decided from above, so to speak, and there's not really even a process, or is there a process?
There's a process, but it's the same people who ignored my complaints before, and it's the same people that testified, you know, against me. So, for instance, none of the people who retaliated against me and discriminated against me, nobody's been disciplined. So, like, that says wonders. Where I lost my job for 2 years. My family was without a significant income for 2 years. And my harassers, nothing happened to them. Not even, I mean, and it states in our protocols that in terms of discrimination, they're supposed to get like a minimum of 15 days suspension. Nobody's gotten that. I would have seen it.
And so you have a new chief, and we followed that, and I guess that women were not even considered in the final list, so to speak.
I wasn't a part of the conversation. I wasn't included in this, but from my understanding is that my opinions do not represent the opinions, or my views do not represent the views of the fire department, but from what I was told was that it included four names from this past fire chief were handed to the mayor, and that no women's names were included, and there was two women who could potentially have been included.
And out of curiosity, is there any kind of opening for community questions? In other words, people in the community that they might be concerned what's happening. Maybe they're concerned about their daughters or their granddaughters, and they want to know what's happening. Is there any channel that people can get involved in this conversation?
Yeah, of course. You can call the mayor. There's people. These are your elected officials, and they are making the decisions based upon, you know, pretty much what they want. But also, I mean, your opinion matters. You elect them. This is your tax money paying everybody's salaries. And if you're not happy with something, you call, you write in, you tweet, you do whatever social media that you do, and ask important questions. Because there are questions that if you're an employee, it's hard to ask because you might face retaliation.
Well, you know, the journey for justice is very hard, and equality. And I'm so sorry that you're having so many obstacles. But, you know, to me, being a firefighter is a very, very important part of our community. I think we will forever, you know, see 9/11, but also I was from Chicago, and so we certainly historically knew about the Chicago fire and the devastation there. And they are just really one of the real pillars of our community.
They are.
And so I just think it's so important that this is an area where women can want to go. To me, they have natural talents that they can really give so much to the community. And we have to address this. And so, I'm going to keep following you, because first of all, I want to know what's happening. And I think we all want to know what's happening. And I really admire the efforts and the fortitude you have to show, because deep down, I'm sure you still really want to be a fire rescue person.
I would love it if they just gave me a chance to do my job. no, seriously, I would love it. I would love to just be at a station with a crew and just do my job and be good at it. Because, I mean, I'm good at this job. So I would love a chance to actually shine at it, because I know I would.
Well, Tanya Vidovich, I wish we could keep talking longer, but we can't today. But thank you so much for coming in. Thanks for all you're doing. Hang in there. It's worth it. All the women really, need your kind of efforts, and we'll back you and see what's happening.
Okay. Well, thank you guys for having me. It's always lovely.
And when we pulled up this morning, looked over and saw Tanya out in the grounds here at WMNF pulling weeds. I mean, that's the kind of person she is, I thought. Isn't that nice?
Oh, I do what I can.
Well, it's really important. So, okay. Well, let's try and make Arlene. You look like you wanted to say something.
Well, I wanted to say that support for WMNF comes from our members and UF Online, providing education to qualified students. As a top 10 public university, online students earn the same degree as their on-campus counterparts. Students can apply by June 11th for fall. UF Online students don't just log in, they connect. And I also promised you last week that we would have some tickets to give away, and we do have a pair of tickets to go to the whole three-day weekend.
This is a deal, people.
The Folk Festival.
Florida Folk Festival up in White Springs. The lovely Suwannee. Thanks so much, Tanya. You take care. And so this is a big deal. So I'm going to put the music on.
You can call us if you'd like those tickets. It's a three-day event, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Oh, May 25th through the 27th, sorry. And, there are over 300 performers. I don't know. They have at least 5 stages and all kinds of impromptus. It is it's beautiful. It's a great way to get just have a wonderful weekend right on the Suwannee and hear all this great music and the diversity. And I noticed that so much of it is emphasizing the diversity of the state, the Haitians, the Cubans, et cetera, all of that. And I noticed that's kind of an emphasis. I see a lot of performers on the various stages this week. So anyway, I'm going to put this music on, but I'm not going to play the music very much, because then I'm going to go into Medea Benjamin, which I recorded yesterday, and so we can be answering the phone. So no, don't call yet. Don't call
yet. That's okay. But okay. I'm going to take the third caller, 813-239-9663. 813-239-9663.
Well, instead of music, I'm going to put on Medea Benjamin, because I do want to get to, the segment later. So, okay. Medea Benjamin. Well, I am so happy to welcome back to the show Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink. She's been a guest on this show many times. And Medea, Monday was a pretty significant hard day for an awful lot of us to watch. And so tell me, what do you think about, the opening of the embassy, the proposal at least, because they don't have any building. And so tell me, were you watching the split screens of any of the television coverage? Were you seeing any of that?
Well, yes, it was horrendous. We were at the White House that day protesting, but we were also watching it. And to see the spectacle of the administration, members of Congress, the official delegation, all smiling and praising the moving of the embassy, while at the same time the snipers were shooting down peaceful protesters in Gaza was a horrible thing to witness.
Yeah, and you know the conditions in Gaza are so deplorable. And so, Medea, real quickly, kind of summarize the conditions in Gaza, where I imagine a lot of people, being they really couldn't get out if they wanted to, probably think, well, you know, if we can't return, we might as well go down trying.
Well, that's one of the biggest issues, Mary, is that people are held captive. They're not allowed to leave either through the border with Egypt or through the border with Israel. There is no airport that functions. No shipping is allowed to come in. People are really stuck there. And there is a 25,000-person backlog of people signed up who want to leave through the Egyptian border called the Rafah border. But it's only been open just maybe one or two days a month, and hardly any people are able to get out of there. So people feel trapped. There's so few employment opportunities. There's so few opportunities to get access to resources to start your own business. Only a couple of hours of electricity a day. The water is poisonous, and people are drinking it every day because they have no other options. So people live in a state of desperation, and you really have to ask yourself, why would people risk walking to the fence and knowing they could get shot at by Israeli snipers or tear gassed by drones overhead? And that is because they are desperate. So you saw families coming there, children coming there, women coming there. And the most aggressive response from the Israelis, none of those protesters posed a threat to Israel. Not one soldier was hurt on the Israeli side. Not one Israeli citizen was hurt. So these were not clashes. This was really a massacre by the Israelis.
And when I heard some of the doctors talking about some of the nature of the injuries and they're kind of using the kind of ammunition that explodes on impact, and so you have these egregious wounds that actually, if the person survives, they're probably going to lose that limb, and then the drones dropping the tear gas, that you kind of realize that in a way this is almost an experimental laboratory for a new kind of weaponry.
Well, it certainly is, and the Israelis brag about that. But there were children who were suffocated by the tear gas, and people said, well, why would parents bring their children? Well, they kept the children quite far away from the fence area, and yet when the drones came in and dropped the tear gas, it affected people in the whole radius there. And when you also have to understand how scarce the medicines are in the hospitals there, even under regular circumstances. So with the thousands and thousands of people who have been injured, the hospitals are totally unable to care for these people, which is why so many people are going to have their limbs amputated. And then Gaza is one of the most unfriendly places in terms of being accessible by wheelchair, because people don't have ramps. There isn't, quote, spare cement to be able to build, to make places wheelchair accessible or to put in elevators in buildings. So if people are injured and have to be wheelchair bound, it means really it's very hard for them to get out of the house. So a life of misery, a life of family members having to take care of that person. So we have to not think of only those who were murdered, but the thousands of people who will sustain such terrible injuries for the rest of their lives.
And yesterday was the 70th anniversary of Nakba. And I guess what, since March 30th, actually, the Palestinians have had started a march for returns. And so tell me, Medea, what are even any kind of proposals for peace or whatever? Is there anything even on the table to try and work with this situation?
There is absolutely nothing on the table. I mean, if it weren't so tragic, it would be funny to hear them talk about a peace process, because there really is no peace process. And certainly with the provocative move of the embassy to Jerusalem, and then on top of that, this horrendous way that the Israelis have dealt with the peaceful protests, it puts any possibility, as remote as there ever was, even more remote. So it's part of the desperation that Palestinians all over feel, not just those in Gaza, but those living in the West Bank, those living in East Jerusalem, and those living in the diaspora, who are desperate to see their family members live under better conditions. We're desperate to see their families be able to leave and come visit them in the United States, in Europe, or wherever they live. So this is really a very clear indication that there is absolutely no peace process.
And also the way they, the celebration, having Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, but those two ministers, I mean, having Robert Jeffress and then also John Hagee, I mean, these people have some pretty despicable views, particularly Jeffress, of just about every religion except, I guess, whatever his is. And I found those were kind of an amazing choice. But isn't he on Trump's evangelical board or religious advisory board?
Yes, it is amazing. You know, they gave Obama such a hard time for his relationship with a minister who wasn't didn't meet 100% the critics' views, and yet Trump gets to pick the most racist, anti-Muslim, anti-Jewish people as his religious representatives. And where is the outcry about that? I found it just horrific that those were the two people who were representing the Trump administration from a faith-based viewpoint, which should be the people who are the most moral, the most compassionate, the ones who are calling for a process that would bring all people together. And instead, you have people who are really haters or evangelical preacher who thinks the apocalypse is the way to is the future and the reason to be supportive of Israel.
Yeah, the end times. That's part of it, that Israel has to have in charge, I think, of Jerusalem. And so it's
right, not because they care about the Jewish people, but because that's where the rapture will happen.
Yeah, and also then, as I understand it, some members of the Progressive Caucus in the House, co-chair Mark Pocan and Dan Kilby and Hank Johnson Jr., they all want to go to Gaza to get a firsthand account to see how all their military spending is being made, and they've tried before. Do you think there's any chance that they'll be able to get to Gaza?
Well, to be honest, Mary, I was surprised that the Israelis even let journalists in, because so many times they just block out any news reporting from Gaza. But to think that Congress people who represent the entity, the body that allocates the $3.8 billion a year that goes to Israel, and these people are denied entry, it's just such an affront. And you would think that the administration would say, whoa, wait a minute, you know, our representatives are the ones who approve this money. They should have the ability to see how this money is being used. And yet, not a word from the administration pushing on the Israelis to allow these congressmen to go in.
Yeah, and also following on the heels of backing out of the Iran agreement and watching what's happening in Syria, I think the Middle East just seems a very desperate place of just conflagration right now.
Mary, I think we could have never imagined 16 years ago, after the invasion of Iraq, that the Middle East would be in such dire straits and potentially becoming even more catastrophic, as you said, with the Trump administration pulling out of the Iran deal and the proxy wars that are already taking place in countries like Yemen and Syria and Libya. And these can get worse now with, and already we see an increase in the skirmishes between Israel and Iran that are playing out inside Syria as well as in the Golan Heights. So there's potential for a war with Iran, a country of 80 million people that has over a million people in the military. The what the Middle East needs now is not a new war, but to find solutions to the ones that have been raging for so long. And one thing that the Trump administration really does not understand is that there will be no solution to any of the conflicts in the Middle East right now if we don't work with Iran.
Yeah, and, you know, I can't remember the name of the man, actually, but you know, when the United States was invading Iraq, and he said, if they invade Iraq, they are going to open the gates of hell. And it seems that he was prescient, you know.
Well, right, and the gates of hell that have led to the creation of groups like ISIS as a result of that invasion, and we see the spreading of ISIS now that is a competitor to Al-Qaeda, and no end in sight. And the U.S. arming extremist groups, the Saudis arming groups, the Iranians getting in there to try to keep these groups from entering Iran with the same thought of better to fight them in other countries than to fight them here. And so it's an absolute disaster. We don't know what's going to become of the Iran nuclear deal, if the Europeans are going to be able to hold it together by finding some way to shelter their companies from the secondary sanctions that the U.S. is going to be trying to impose, or if the Iranians are going to go along or finally say, you know, screw this. Why should we stay in this deal when we're getting no economic benefits, when Israel has its nuclear weapons and doesn't have to open itself up for any inspections? And certainly there are those voices inside Iran who are saying, we told you never negotiate with the West, with the United States. They can't be trusted. Well, they turned out to be very prescient. And so we don't know which way things are going to go. But I certainly hope that the Europeans and the Chinese and the Russians are able to convince the Iranians that it's in their best interest to stay in the deal, find some ways to give them some economic relief, and have it be the Trump administration and the United States that is isolated, not the Iranians who are complying with the deal.
So we're going to have to hope that the rest of the world has a little more sense and a little more morality than we do, because, you know, Medea, you have fought for peace and justice and equality all your life. You have gone everywhere. And also, I'm sure that the unbelievable, almost surreal world right now in Korea, where people were clamoring to have Trump get the Nobel Peace Prize, and North Korea has given notice that they don't think it's a good idea that the United States and South Korea are going to have these military maneuvers, and so the talks might be off. And so, you know, if it weren't so serious, it would be almost an amazing farce play watching this. But instead, it's just the opposite. So where do you see any hope, other than you hope the rest of the world has more of a moral center?
last week I would have said Korea.
I know, but...
And, you know, I am on my way again with Christine on, and when we cross the DMZ, we're leaving next week. And we're anxious to meet with the people in South Korea and the non-Americans who are going to North Korea. We're not allowed to go, thanks to Trump. But I still think there's hope in Korea because of President Moon from South Korea, and because of the Korean people being so determined to find a solution. And, you know, we do talk about the rest of the world wanting to see an end to these wars. And let's hope there's cooler heads within the U.S. military, the ones like James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, who is seen as a practical hawk, never liked Iran, never was always wanted regime change in Iran, but understands how dangerous that could be. So hope, I think, is never giving up the struggle, even in these very, very difficult times, and reaching out to the people in our country and in other countries who also want to avoid a new conflict and want to find ways to resolve conflicts peacefully.
Well, you certainly have dedicated your life to that, Medea, and Code Pink and an awful lot of women. And so, and it just seems that the good things that are happening and the good intents and wishes and the efforts of people don't get nearly the attention and encouragement that the really bad things do. And so we will hope that light and hope and justice finally prevail. So, Medea, I know I'm catching you a really busy time, and I really wish you well, and be careful. And thanks again for giving us all this time. You do take care.
Thank you, Mary. And one last thing, if people want to sign an apology to the Iranian people, we have a wonderful letter on our website, codepink.org, where they can sign up, and we will be publishing that in newspapers all over Iran.
Yeah, I really suggest that people go to your website. It really is very navigable, and it's very interesting and fun. And yes, and I thought that was just a beautiful kind of a little poster card you had with that. I thought it was beautifully done, the artwork.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Mary. Much love.
You take care. Bye-bye. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
And Medea, always, always, always a beacon of hope, even when times are hard. And Arlene, I know you wanted to say something.
Oh, I was going to tell her to be safe.
Oh, but I talked to her yesterday.
Yes.
I swear, I don't know quite what we were talking. You know, the metro was late. They had problems in D.C. yesterday. And so she found this spot. And so I was really kind of leery. But, you know, with a few wah-wahs I heard, I have no idea. I never want to know. I'm just always glad that she seems healthy and well. So anyway, let's just play this a little promo. And then we're going to come back with Dan Robertson, Carol Hartley.
30th and ends on Wednesday, June 6th. We are seeking restaurants, caterers, and chefs to feed our volunteers taking your pledges. We have many ways to thank you. Find out more about donating drinks, snacks, or a meal by contacting me, Miss Julie, at 813-238-8001 or email missjulie@wmnf.org.
Oh, indeed. Marathon is coming up, and we hope we hear from you. I think ours is the second day, the 31st, right?
Yes, that's correct. It'll be 2 weeks from today, so mark it. You can go ahead and put your contribution in the tip jar now if you'd like to. Just go to WMNF.org, go to From a Woman's Point of View page, and you will be connected to the tip jar, and you can put in whatever you would like. We do need to hear from you.
Okay, I'm going to put this music on, and we'll come back with Carl Hartley and Jan Roberts. Down because I'm very excited that we have both of our guests. We have both Jan Roberts and Carla Hartley with us. And so they have a very, I think, terrific program that's going to be happening Friday and Saturday, May 18th and 19th. So Jan Roberts and Carla, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you, Mary.
Well, Jan Roberts, I remember you from the Earth Charter. You know, that was an amazing event. You had some of the most extraordinary, really world leaders here. And really, I've always found it just a really real highlight from Tampa. And so you have been quite busy since then. Now, I want to tell you, because you founded the Earth Charter and you were an NGO delegate to the United Nations Commission on Sustainable Development. You taught at University of Tampa. And but now, I guess now for the last 4 years, you and your Prius, you decided to look around this country and bring us, I think, some hopeful people and some people who are accomplishing something at a most necessary time. And so is that what this is about?
Yeah, it is, Mary. It's a road trip that I took, but I actually took it over a period of 2.5 months in my Prius. I did 13,000 so many miles and shot 51 videos, but I came back with a whole load of change makers across the country. The Earth Charter was one part of my journey as an activist. I've been an activist for more than 40 years. So I have just met these incredible, passionate people doing really deep-seated change across the country in all that time. And I wanted to capture their stories, and I thought videotaping them was a good way to do it and get them up on my website. So that was the impetus for my going. Plus, my husband had died from Alzheimer's, and I wanted to get out of Dodge.
I can understand that. But tell me, Jan, because you've always been a very positive, forward-thinking person. And so, you know, and you know, when we're looking at our times, really, frankly, things have been going south for quite a while. This just didn't all happen with Trump. And so, and you, with all your contacts with sustainable development and all of these areas and being an NGO and speaking at the UN, you must have had in mind trying to talk to some people who were accomplishing things, who weren't being on the large scale. They weren't being talked about. Because what did you believe, that people always have a way not only to survive, but that they will deal with this situation if you give them a chance? And so is that what you kind of had in mind?
Yeah, my approach always, Mary, has been the grassroots approach, because it's at that level that change is really taking place. And but what is happening now, there is such a movement, especially in the new economy, with initiatives that put people and the planet first, that this is starting at the ground with the community level, but it's able to be replicated into models that could affect the national policies. An example is in Cleveland. They have the Evergreen Cooperatives. Those are worker-owned cooperatives. They're industrial-sized, commercial laundry, commercial alternative energy place company, all owned by the workers, all share in the profits, all start at living wages. They have health and medical benefits and retirement. And that is a model, because it has captured the purchasing power in Cleveland of the university, Cleveland Clinic, the university hospital. So this whole approach of not doing just low-level mom-and-pop work-grown cooperatives, but large-scale industrial ones that keep the money that there's billions of dollars that our universities and our hospitals put into commodities and services that could be delivered locally, but very often aren't. And that's the approach of these work-grown cooperatives.
Well, you know, that is so important, Jan. And tell me, because I imagine it started kind of small scale, but how, did they have the vision from the start that they just didn't want this to be for their own little local community, but they wanted to reach the Cleveland Clinic and all these big institutions? And were those institutions really very receptive to say, hey, because they kind of all share that they want the people. They want a different, you know, emphasis in this country, not just for our war machine and our mega, mega money, but for people.
Yeah, from the very beginning, I would definitely tell your listeners to go to democracycollaborative.org, and they'll see all these initiatives happening all around the country if they want more information about it. But yes, it started with that in mind, that this was going to be based on a Mondragon model in Spain, where the money that comes in, 10%, goes into a fund, an incubator fund for more worker-owned cooperatives. And so that's how they keep growing and building. And we've got this anchor model approach now happening in Rochester, New York, and Richmond, Virginia. I'd love to see it in Tampa, Mary.
Well, I'm going to bring Carla Hartley here. Carla, so how did you get exposed to Jan's project? And what a challenge. How are you going to handle this kind of presentation where you're going to bring some of her videos, because she took videos all along, and some of the things that were happening? How did you find out about this, and how did you respond to this challenge?
Well, I mean, Jan and I have been familiar with each other sort of peripherally for many, many years. She's been a great friend of the theaters. So we would chat on that level. And we're members of the Athena Society of Tampa Bay, which meets monthly. And she did a presentation about her. Because she's written a book based on her travels. So she did a presentation based on what that trip was all about. And I immediately thought that it would make a terrific evening of theater. Because Jan is very engaging. She's really keeps your attention, and she's a positive person. And I thought that it would be great to take a crack at it, to take the videos and have her write the story and see where we could get, you know, an hour 15 to an hour and a half of really quality material, both to get across, the work that she's been doing and the discoveries around the country that she made about positive change making, but also to take some of the personal stuff that was going on with her about her husband having passed and why she needed to take this trip. Because it's not really, I mean, the finding out about the work that we're seeing around the country is very important. But for theater, there's everything has to become personal. The universal must be personal, right? So that's how we approached it. And Jen's been working real hard. We've worked a couple times a week for the last couple of months. And she's learning how difficult it is to be an actor.
Well, you know, Carla and Jan, when I first read about it, you know, I didn't know anything about it, and I immediately thought of the bucket list, you know, so to speak. And we have all these movies, et cetera, of these guys that take off, you know, it's near the end, and they have their bucket list, and they have their guy's adventure going off, usually two of them. And I thought, what a difference. Here's an older woman that's, you know, just, you know, had a devastating loss with her husband, then to go through that. That's a very, very hard journey. But isn't a bucket list. You're going on an adventure list to actually show openings, you know, of a continuum. It's kind of the opposite of a bucket. If any way, the raindrop is going up.
Yes. I think it's
the quintessential example of the masculine to the feminine, I think, right?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Never mind. Go ahead, Jim.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say, I had a passion for this, Mary, too, and that's what drove me, because Carla will tell you, I get lost trying to get out of the StageWorks building, and I didn't even know how to use a video camera when I took off, and I was by myself and did this. So if I can do it, anybody can do it.
Oh, you're like Studs Terkel. You never knew how to use this tape recorder.
Video camera, yeah.
Yeah. And so the people he was talking to helped him, and it turned out to be quite an adventure. But I think that's fabulous. I really do, and not only courage, but tell me, Jan, because you had to plan this, you know, going all these states, et cetera, and all this traveling. But did you find you got exposed to something you never expected? So you're like, hey, I want to talk about this.
Yeah, I absolutely did. I probably had about 65% that I knew about before I got there. But on the road, I landed in Portland, Oregon to do one video interview. I ended up doing seven.
Oh, great.
So it was just... all along the way, I kept the door open for what I would hear. But the important piece here is that what I was covering was not doing good to address the symptoms of society, but addressing the causes. And that's what filled me with such a passion, to really get that word out. Do you know, Mary, just for example, we can close the achievement gap in high schools. It was done in Tucson in seven schools by an ethnic teacher.
I am going to have to interrupt you here, because the people can go and they can hear you talk about that. That sounds like a tease, because I want to get this out. It's going to be at StageWorks Theater. It's going to be Friday and Saturday, May 18th and 19th, and it should be delightful. So,
Carla,
Arlene,
give the address of StageWorks.
I've got the...
The web address is Dazework Theater with an RE.org. The space is down on the Channel Side in the 1100 block of East Kennedy.
1120 East Kennedy.
1120, right. And it's going to be at 8 p.m., and it sounds well worth it. So, okay, thanks to both of you for being so patient. And good luck. I think it's going to be outstanding.
Thank you, guys.
Bye. Thanks again. Bye-bye. That's pretty amazing. Carla's Year of the Woman continues. And you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater. Stay tuned for the news. And so thanks, people, for being here.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend.